that she was a girl from Tiger Bay. Understandable of her, I suppose. It does have a bit more of a ring about it than the girl from Splot. To most people nowadays, Cardiff Dockland is the Millennium Centre, a clutch of restaurants and large blocks of flats and condos, and is now the regular haunt of day trippers, theatre-goers and tourists. But a few of us are old enough to remember the Bay at the fag end of its glory days as the second biggest port in the world, and which had become known to thousands of merchant seamen across the world as Tiger Bay. Then policemen patrolled the streets in threes, and honest folk of the town never ventured anywhere near it, especially after dark. So dangerous and violent did it become that there were questions asked in Parliament about the lawlessness of Cardiff's waterfront. How did it come about? Cardiff achieved its prominence because of King Coal. The best steam coal in the world had been found deep underground a few miles north of the city. And when coal burners began replacing windjammers and trains began steaming across continents all over the globe, the demand for Welsh coal became insatiable. The amount exported from Cardiff jumped from 0 tons in 1806 to nearly 4 million tons 60 years later and carried on increasing. Cardiff then became known as the coal metropolis, the greatest coal port on the planet. In fact, in terms of overall tonnage handled, only New York was a busier port. But as the business of the port increased, so did many other problems. Extra docks had to be constructed to accommodate the explosion of ships waiting to berth. So to build them and the Dockland streets nearby, an army of Irish labourers was smuggled into the city as ballast in cargoless ships. Hundreds of men and their families also flocked to the docks as stevedores, coal trippers, timmers, crane operators, porters, railwaymen, and into this mix, of course, flowed the seamen. Chinese, Lascars, Africans, Norwegians, Latvians, Maltese, West Indians, Levantines, Arabs, and many others. It was a combustible mix, especially when you factor in the avarice of many ship owners. It became one of the most notorious waterfronts in the world, one that seamen felt worthy of being called Sailor Town. You can read that, you're lucky. A sailor town has been described as a world in, but not of, the landsman. As one seafarer put it, a sailor was much safer at sea, hanging on by his eyebrows and toenails to an upper yardarm in a storm, or reefing sail in the roaring 40s, than he was in a sailor town. There, every boarding house master, harpy, and wharf rat was waiting to skin him or slug him, and where his useless corpse was often found with a knife between his ribs, lying sprawled in some dark alley or fished out of the dock. This is no exaggeration. It happened to a former classmate of mine in another port. He was 18, third mate on a freighter, until in Buenos Aires he was pulled out of the River Plate with his throat cut. This sort of thing was endemic in Cardiff in spades, and it came about as a result of the exploitation of the method of crewing ships in those days. It was similar to the way sailors were press-ganged into the Royal Navy during the same period, except that it was called crimping. And it was not official, but for economic reasons, the authorities at all levels turned a blind eye to it. Nearly all ships in those days were tramps. In other words, they picked up a cargo in one port, took it to another, where they waited to pick up a further cargo and then deliver that and so on until they finally arrived back in their home port. Then the shipping company would pay off the crew. These voyages often took years, so the wage bill could be very large. But if a member or members of the crew deserted, they were off the payroll and didn't need to be paid at all. And the ship owners did not replace them for as long as it took to unload the cargo and wait for another. And only when the ship was ready to sail would the master take on a new crew and then, of course, trouser the unpaid wages. Hands were hired in those days using the advance note system. A shipping master in a port, a sort of booking agent for seamen, could issue an advance note to the sailor to the value of about 2 months' future wages, ostensibly to buy his gear and clothing. This could be redeemed by the agent from the shipping company when the vessel had sailed with the crewmen on board. This was when the crimps moved in, sometimes dishonest tailors, but more usually crooked boarding house keepers, who would immediately advance cash against the note for services rendered until the seaman sailed. This was always at a usurious rate of interest. Often the sailor would be lucky to get a third of its value. When the seaman was safely in the boarding house keeper's clutches, he would be plied with cheap moonshine alcohol or harmless drinks spiked with drugs until he was unconscious. The shipping agent would then sign him on the first appropriate boat that was outward bound, and he would then wake up at sea, going he knew not where, often possessing only what he woke up in, after being robbed of what little he possessed by the boarding house keeper who'd advanced him the money in the first place. To a much lesser degree, this went on in most ports, and the seamen knew it, but still many went ashore of their own free will. In this contemporaneous sketch by an old salt, here is one doing so by what they called paying off with a jib downhaul. Why did they do that? Herman Melville, the American writer and poet of Moby Dick fame and a seafarer himself, wrote in Billy Budd, in his rather grandiloquent prose, the typical sailor of the early 19th century was a man who habitually lived with the elements, but knowing little more of the land than as a beach, or rather that portion of the terraqueous globe, set apart for dance halls, drinking and opium dens, and was a natural prey for the land sharks, the crooked landlords, tailors, and barkeepers, and so on. Whoops. In those days, sailors were of an adventurous disposition, footloose bachelors by choice, who were wonderful men at sea, but who often deteriorated ashore. But as Alan Villiers, the Australian mariner and writer, pointed out, they were mostly God-fearing men. He wrote, "On my first voyage as a boy, I sat down to eat my hash with my hat on. An aged, hawk-faced, slightly humpbacked Irish shellback sent my hat flying, following its removal with a hefty clout round my ear, and remarking at the same time, 'Doff your hat, sonny, and honour your maker.' It's something I've never forgotten. I don't mean to say that all seafarers were saints, but nobody deserved the treatment they received ashore, even sometimes on board as well." Tars at sea. Wonder if it's gone mad, this one.
Do you want to go backwards?
Yeah, it's gone.
Let's go up upon that arrow, is it? Which one were you looking for, Brian?
That one. That'll do. But why, after once being bitten, did they come back time and time again, asking, like Oliver Twist, for more? I think the following quote from Robert Louis Stevenson, writing in 1897, partly answers this. "The forecastle hand was not often gulled, but after a long, hard passage, the pleasures of a one-night spree became magnified out of all proportion." But it wasn't always the mariner's own fault. As I've said previously, it was in the skipper and the owner's financial interests for the vessel in port to be crewless for as long as possible. So they often encouraged hands to jump ship. If they didn't oblige, the crimps worked another scam. While the skipper pointedly looked the other way, crimps with gangs of heavies would go on board and kidnap the sailors, usually by blagging or drugging them, then carry them off the ship and lock them safely up in a boarding house or a safe house out of town. They would then get a tame shipping master to book them on the next outward bounder he could find needing hands. As soon as this was done, they would dump them on board until still drugged, drunk, sometimes even dead. There they are. Oh, see, it's gone again.
Up, right.
It's jumping.
Yeah. Was it that one?
That's right, yeah. That's another contemporaneous sketch of them being dumped on board. So much money. Wait a minute, where am I? But it wasn't only the sailors. Anyone foolish enough to go into the bay at that time on his own could wake up and find himself on a ship and never seen again. But Cardiff had a unique problem which made the plight of the seafarer much worse than in other ports in the country. So much money was being made exporting coal by the ship and coal owners, the railway companies, and successive Marquesses of Bute, who owned the docks, that they neglected to build any import facilities or diversify into other industries. These were monumental mistakes. Even Lloyd George came to Cardiff to speak to the Chamber of Commerce and urged them to go to the Tyne or the Clyde, where exports went hand in hand with imports and manufacturing industries, and ask themselves why Cardiff, with its vast reserves of raw materials nearby, hadn't developed into one of the greatest engineering centres in the country. But he wasted his breath. Nothing changed. Cardiff became what seamen called an outport, with timber for pit props being about the only imported goods of any quantity. So the last leg of most tramps' voyages was to bring the homeward-bound cargo into another UK port. This left the seamen in an even worse position, because the ship owners paid them off at the import port, Liverpool, London, or Southampton, for example, leaving the sailors to make their way to Cardiff to find a ship as best they could, usually on foot. When the ship had been unloaded, the owners would sail the vessel in ballast to Cardiff with a skeleton crew for more coal. The seamen, of course, had already arrived in the docks, broke and hungry, easy prey for the crimps. It was largely as a consequence of this policy, or lack of it, that Cardiff developed into a waterfront with, as the sailors saw it, a tiger in it. There were only two other tiger bays in the world. Wapping in London was one, and Georgetown in Demerara, now called Guyana, was the other. In Guyana, reed for coal, sugar. The practice of sending ships to Cardiff in ballast led to a large floating population of hard-up foreign seamen in the docks, and the police had their work cut out to maintain order. There were large-scale disturbances, interracial street riots, and Chinese laundries were set on fire at different times. This was when the questions were asked in Parliament about the evils of the advance notice system for crewing ships. But after a long debate, nothing transpired. The big money was on the side of the status quo. By this time, crimps had become all-powerful on Cardiff's waterfront, and they controlled many shipping agents by intimidating them to sign only seamen who had come from their boarding houses. These agents, who tried to buck the system, risked being beaten up and robbed, or even worse, some were fished dead out of the Glamorganshire Canal. But in the first year of the 20th century, the demand for coal began to diminish. Diesel oil started having an impact on the railways and the shipping industries. And as there was little alternative employment, as trade fell away, the city of Cardiff, as well as the docks, declined in importance. This led to much poverty and hardship, which brought its own problems of law and order. And the police service was just as busy, but now fighting more conventional crime, the crimps having long departed. But the name Tiger Bay stuck. Year upon year, the docks trade declined until by just after the Second World War, there was hardly anything worth the name. Then it was only after nearly 30 or so impoverished years that the docks began to be redeveloped into what we have today. Let's hope we can find it. Ah, there we are. Now virtually nothing remains of Cardiff's massive, if checkered, maritime history. And the fact that this is the case amounts, I think, to a kind of civic vandalism. I am not suggesting that all the mean and grubby streets should have been kept, but a small section of the waterfront, the pierhead perhaps, the stately Loudon Square, once the home of wealthy ship owners, some nearby streets and wharves with perhaps a coal tipper and an old windjammer or a tramp steamer tied up, could, with a bit of ingenuity, have turned a section of the docks into a sort of St. Fagans-on-Sea. Anything to show that South Wales was once a force to be reckoned with on the oceans of the world. An almost unique way of life existed in Cardiff sailor town. Also, what the growth and decline of Cardiff docks does illustrate is what a combination of avarice and lack of forward planning can result in. Most of the vast profits of coal and shipping were siphoned away from the Principality, with little or no reinvestment to turn Cardiff into a well-balanced port with an import as well as an export trade, or expand into the hinterland with engineering and metal industries to the detriment of the working population of South Wales. Lloyd George was right. On Tyneside, for instance, there is still a considerable manufacturing base of ship repair, offshore services, engineering, electronics, clothing, furniture, paper products, timber, and the manufacture of small precision instruments. But in Cardiff, there seemed to be no thought for the welfare of future generations. Looking at Cardiff docks and the valleys now, it's difficult not to think of Timothy 1, 6:10. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For money is the root of many kinds of evil. Thank you. Hope you weren't too bored.